This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Apologies, we've had a little break over the last week or so, some technical difficulties, but here we are, back again. So, we've got a treat for you today. I'm discussing the Diary of Anne Frank, the dramatisation of the Diary of Anne Frank, and the history of that dramatisation, its cultural and social effects, and the effects on how we understand and remember the Holocaust. And I'm talking with writer and the editor of Forward Podcast, Adam Langer, about his inquiries into the history of this dramatization and how the book is adapted and became a worldwide phenomenon, and the effect that that had on everything from the McCarthyite era in America through to the civil rights struggle. Anyway, without further ado, let's begin, and we'll hear from Adam and his story.
Okay, and welcome again, everyone, to the Explaining History podcast. I'm joined today by Adam Langer. Adam is the executive editor of the Forward podcast and author of Playing Anne Frank. And we are going to talk today about the story, not of the life of Anne Frank necessarily, but almost the kind of the afterlife in literature of Anne Frank, and how the book came to be dramatised, and a little bit of kind of around that whole topic area. So, firstly, welcome, Adam. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to talk about whatever you would like to talk about today,
okay. And
I will do my best to be clear and precise.
Perhaps you can tell us a bit about your interest in the story of the Diary of Anne Frank and how this has kind of emerged and where you've gone with that.
Right, of course. Well, I come at this not in the manner of a historian. I This started out as a novel that I wrote that was published in August. I wrote a novel called Cyclorama that was published in August by Bloomsbury. And it is about a group of high school kids in the 1980s who perform in a production of The Diary of Anne Frank. And it is a very fraught and traumatic production. And it the novel is about how this experience of appearing in the dramatization of The Diary of Anne Frank goes on to impact their lives. So it visits them in the 1980s, and then it zips forward to the 21st century, and to show how playing these roles affected their lives and changed their lives and changed their futures, the impact of this production. So once I was done with the novel, I mean, fiction writing is an act of imagination. And I became curious of what actually happened to the people who were in the original production of The Diary of Anne Frank. The show debuted on Broadway in 1955. It toured the world in the late 1950s. There were productions in dozens of productions in South America, in Europe, and throughout America. A touring company went to more than 100 cities in the United States in the late 1950s. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how this affected the people in it. What is it like to live out these stories, to live out the story of The Diary of Anne Frank day after day and night after night? So I went in search of the people who were in the production. I talked to people who played these roles on Broadway, who played these roles in America, who were in, there was a 1959 Oscar-winning film of The Diary of Anne Frank. I talked to the actresses who played Anne Frank and her sister Margaret, as well as the son of the director, George Stevens, to really get a sense of, not of, you know, how the history affects us as readers, but about the people who convey the history. How does history affect the people who are performing it? What experience is that like? So that's a little about how the podcast came about, just trying to find the true story, not the fictional one, about the lives of the people who told the story on stage and in film.
What was your sense of, I mean, obviously these people would be, you know, quite elderly now, I'm guessing, the majority of them. What was your sense of their, did they have particularly vivid recollections of that period?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, it's, it was, you know, it, in some way it's difficult to say, like every role an actor plays or film has the effect of impacting their life in some way or fashion, and it could be wholly apart from the roles they're playing. But in this instance, talking to people who played Anne Frank, talking to people who played her sister or the heroic neighbors who tried to shield them for 2 years in hiding while the Gestapo was in search for them, I really had a sense talking to them that this changed them in some way. This was not an ordinary play. This was something that kind of changed their worldviews. There was one person who I actually didn't talk to who went out after the show, the actor who played Peter Van Den, the boy with whom Anne is in hiding and has in the play a kind of an innocent sort of romantic relationship with. Shortly after he was done filming, he went out to Mississippi to work for to register black voters. And wow. He made a documentary about it in which he quoted Anne Frank and to relate it to the situation in the American South. And just everyone I talked to just was really impacted by it. And everyone sort of, you know, either they were done with theater and they wanted to do something more useful in the world, or they became really serious about the sorts of parts they took or their social responsibility. So as one of the actors in it who I talked to said, it wasn't an ordinary play. As she said, it felt like a responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, you know, part of the reason for the book existing in the first place as a published text was and Frank's father, Otto Frank, seeing that he had this huge responsibility to tell his daughter's story, and also for it to have a kind of, you know, this is, it was a man greatly wedded to kind of humanistic ideas, and thinking that it could have some educational value around the world.
Yeah, it's fascinating actually to see how involved Otto Frank was in the creation of the play. It's not like these days where someone just says, I'm going to option your story, option your book, and Hollywood or Broadway does whatever. He is looking at rewrites. He is meeting with authors. He is sending letters back and forth requesting, this was not true to life. This is, do not include this scene, do include that scene. Mm. And he is very cordial, gentlemanly in an old world sort of fashion as he is. But you know, you can go into the archives of the producers and you can see how involved he was, how seriously he wants this story to be taken and how he wants it to be told. An episode which has not yet aired, it talks about how a couple of people tried to make a musical version of The Diary of Anne Frank. And it almost like everyone who was involved in the dramatization of the story had to make a pilgrimage of sorts to meet Otto Frank, to get their seal of approval. Millie Perkins, who played the role of Anne Frank in the film, the director, the assistant director, they all wanted her, but she first had to meet with Anne Frank's father to get his seal of approval, to see if this is the right person to play his daughter, if these are the right writers to tell the story of his family.
The diary itself is, I mean, it has its own kind of history. If you look at kind of great epochal books of the 20th century, such as Ulysses or Dr. Zhivago or the writings of Solzhenitsyn, they carry make their way around the world and create their own sort of politics. And there are, you know, in after the Second World War, after the crimes of the Nazis were being revealed, there were countries around the world that were, for various different reasons, more reticent than others to discuss the Holocaust at all. In the 1950s in America, it's not that there was any shred of Holocaust denial, but there was a kind of, and it's not even right to call it disinterest, but it certainly wasn't a massive mainstream discourse in the way it is now. Do you think that the dramatization had an effect on not just the actors but the audiences?
Very much so. It's interesting to see, like, Jewish audience as an artists for a time. The shock of what happened during World War II, it took a while for it to start being represented in art. It took a while for artists to begin to assimilate this into their work. And because the Holocaust was not talked about to the degree it is today, the play itself became a de facto form of Holocaust education. I mean, now there are Holocaust education and awareness programs. There wasn't that in the 1950s, and the play became that. So when The Diary of Anne Frank was doing a roadshow, was touring America, was going to places like Spokane, Washington, or Bloomington, Indiana, or Norfolk, Virginia, this was the way that people in those towns who didn't know about the Holocaust, some of whom had never met, not only didn't know about the Holocaust, had never met a Jewish person in their lives. This was how the Jewish story and the Jewish experience was conveyed to them. And the same thing is true in Europe as well. After the war, The Diary of Anne Frank was a massive, experience. In Germany, there were more than 30 productions going on at one time in Germany of this play. So for, people have their issues with the dramatization of the Diary of Anne Frank these days. I mean, some people say the play was too sentimental. Some people say that it was kind of Christianizing a Jewish story. But, you know, at the time, this was many people's first encounter with the story of the Holocaust, this play, and later this film.
Yeah, and I would say certainly for, you know, my schooling was in the mid-1980s, and that's definitely the case. Even then, the first encounter with the story of the Holocaust comes from that. And I suppose, you know, it's a way of humanizing the victims and creating a kind of like, dare I say it, sort of a relatable person to understand.
And that's very much, you know, what the producers in the show had in mind. This was not accidental. This was actually what they wanted to do. And you can read it in this correspondence, how they wanted to make this character relatable, as you would say, to mainstream parentheses read non-Jewish audiences. They were very consciously trying to tell a narrative that would be acceptable at the time. And we have to remember that, you know, looking at The Diary of Anne Frank, the play and the film through 21st century eyes, it can seem a little stagey or dramatic or hokey in some ways. But this was coming out, this was touring America in a time when, you know, the Civil Rights Act hadn't even passed. So it was, the producers were very conscious of trying to bring this story to middle America, as it were, and tell a story that people would be able to understand and hopefully it to sometime open their eyes, change their viewpoints in some way.
Did it ever penetrate the communist world, the Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union?
That's a fascinating question that I do not know the answer to. I would really, you know, I have lists of all the different countries that the show played in the 1950s. Whether it made its way there has not... That sounds like a sequel, like something I would like to investigate. I do not know.
I will correspond with you, and I will endeavor to find out. I should drop you a line with my investigation.
Yeah, I'd be fascinating to know. I would be surprised if it didn't on some level, but when the history of the dramatic production and all the places it played are talked about, that issue is generally not raised.
One of the reasons I ask is that... Holocaust memory and Holocaust politics, you know, throughout the communist and the non-communist world has been used and abused in all sorts of different ways. But particularly the resurgence of a post-war anti-Semitism in East Germany, which was a Stalinist anti-Semitism and motivated for different reasons. It was motivated partly because Israel had become essentially a client state of America after 1948. It was done because Stalin was an anti-Semite anyway. It was done because in East Germany particularly, there was this desire to repress the memory of the Holocaust as being a Jewish tragedy and simply just the fascists did something really horrible to all sorts of different kinds of people, anybody bringing it up to make it a sort of a Jewish tragedy is kind of veering from the party line, and you're getting all sorts of trouble for that. So there was different reasons, but there were also all sorts of anti-Semitic kind of party purges in East Germany and in other Eastern European countries up until 1953, when obviously Stalin dies. And so what you basically in the 1950s, what you think about the Holocaust or what you understand about the Holocaust very much depends on where you are. And obviously, and in Western European countries as well, you know, the Holocaust is very much a kind of a European enterprise. There were collaborators and people in all sorts of European countries persecuting the Jews and assisting the Nazis. It was Dutch police officers who arrested Anne Frank initially. In all of these countries, and you mentioned Germany, obviously, which at the time would have been West Germany.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
In West Germany is probably the one outlier in Europe for the country that puts the most effort into trying to do something about Holocaust education. The French really didn't want to touch it at all.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Yeah, that's true. I did not find much information about I believe there was a French production of The Diary of Anne Frank, now that I'm remembering it, but not to the extent that it was in Germany. It's interesting that you mention like the 1950s and communism, because that was another thing that I found in it. It's interesting because sometimes you look at individual historical phenomena and one doesn't view them in context. So one thing that I found fascinating in my research was that The Diary of Anne Frank was on Broadway during the time of vast anti-communist sentiment in the country, the time of the Red Scare, the time of Red Channels, which was, this publication that was designed to blacklist people in the entertainment industry and who had supposedly communist affiliations or sympathies. And The Diary of Anne Frank, it turns out that there were people involved who were using, not in a conscious sort of way, but who found jobs in the theater because they were blacklisted in other forms of the entertainment industry. So there was one actor in the play who couldn't really find work in the 1950s because he was labeled, communist sympathizer, who is performing his role 8 days a week in Anne Frank. And sometimes he's being dragged to Washington to testify before the House of Un-American Activities Committee about communism in the entertainment industry.
Yeah. And there were, if you look at the numbers of Jewish scriptwriters, directors, actors, and non-entertainment people as well, but there is a kind of a distinctly anti-Semitic flavor to the McCarthyite purges that they never managed to overtly kind of say that it was motivated by anti-Semitism, but it there is a kind of a more than a hint that you know, the enemy within is not just kind of communist, but you know, you have people like the Rosenbergs and things like that. That
yeah, and then it's interesting also because the makeup of the cast of the Diary of Anne Frank in Broadway and its subsequent iterations is, it kind of represents kind of a melting pot of different cultures and backgrounds. There's some actors playing these people who are Jewish, some who are not. One actress who comes from Austria, one actor who comes from Austria, and the kind of it really kind of represents an American experience of sorts, because you have Jews playing Jews, non-Jews playing Jews, touring America. And the religion or background is something that's never really stated or talked about too much among the actors. They kind of have formed their own identity within the theater, and the roles they play and the people they are separate to some extent.
How far do you think the dramatization was one of these kind of cultural tipping points where you go from perhaps indifference through to attention?
Of course, because I've been looking at it so specifically, I feel very much that it was, that this production that came to America and toured the American South and the Heartland, that it was very much kind of a rise in awareness of Holocaust education. It coincides with eyes opening about civil rights and the lead to desegregation movements in schools. How much of that is, this is the Diary of Anne Frank doing that, or how much it is reflective of a time? This was not like the only film or play that talked about the Jewish experience in America, but it certainly was representative. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that this is, you know, the show that changed everything, but I think it's sometimes a little facile to see that, because when you view it in context, there are a lot of different phenomena that are happening coincidentally.
Yeah.
And the Diary of Anne Frank, the play and the film, is part of that.
Yeah, I think probably what happens is you have seminal cultural moments like that, and probably the, you know, Schindler's List being another key one, and those coincide with generational changes. You have new generations seeing these things and forming between themselves collectively different judgments to, or different associations with it, attachments to it than
yeah,
previous generations.
You know, in terms of learning about the Holocaust, I think every generation has, at least since the end of World War II, has its moment where it first learned of the Holocaust. For one generation, it was the Diary of Anne Frank, the play and the film. For a later generation, it was probably, like when I was a kid in grade school, it was probably this miniseries called Holocaust, which was, you know, the first TV miniseries about the Holocaust that starred Meryl Streep and Michael Moriarty. And then in the 1990, I believe that's when Schindler's List came out. For that generation, that's the seminal moment. So there are these different, but there seems to be in every generation like this cultural event that leads to an awareness. And
yeah,
in the 1950s, late 1950s, this was the one.
Yeah. Yeah, and that for me is the interesting bit in the story about how these cultural events and happenings shape our understandings and shape the way in which we conceive of the past. There was a fascinating story. I used to be a Holocaust educator for the British Holocaust Education Trust, and I remember talking to survivors, and initially in Britain during the late 1940s, early 1950s, there again, like America, there was precious little talk about the Holocaust. And one of the reasons for that was It was about the preservation of a British narrative to the war. The British had had a war where they pretty much lost everything that they'd gone to war for. And there was an attempt to reclaim, you know, the spirit of the Blitz and the Battle of Britain and all this sort of stuff. It's a very, very huge part of British character and a remembrance. And other narratives have to get crowded out in order for that to happen. There was a historian, Tony Judd, was talking about, who's a British Jewish historian, and he was talking about his school, his childhood. He said there were, obviously his family weren't particularly affected by the Holocaust. I think distant relatives that he didn't know were affected, were killed. But he said there were other Jewish boys in his school, and you would listen to the British boys talking about their fathers being in the desert with Monty and in the jungles with fighting the Japanese. And the story of the war that the Jewish boys had was, well, you know, my grandparents or my father was in a camp in Poland. And so that the need to in Britain after the war to own the narrative of the war was a kind of a powerful social and cultural way of justifying this pretty disastrous period that we've been through, which resulted in, you know, arguably quite a Pyrrhic victory. And so sometimes you get other narratives that not necessarily force their way in, but there are other narratives, such as the story of Anne Frank, that appear to a population that have never, not that they haven't repressed the knowledge, but they've never considered it. It's never been presented to them. And then you get things starting to change.
Well, this is as true for the audiences who saw this play in this film as it was for the actors in it. They were not immune from this sort of cultural ignorance at the time. For many of the people who were involved in the show, like actors who I talked to who played the role of Anne Frank, they didn't know this story until they were in it. They were, I mean, Jewish actors, non-Jewish actors, this, you know, as they were educating America and the world about the Holocaust and Anne Frank, they were being educated themselves. They didn't know this story, or they had heard, you know, little bits of it that their parents had told them, or little bits that they had read in books. They hadn't read Anne Frank's diary before they performed Anne Frank's diary.
Yeah. And so they are part of that process that the audience is seeing as well, which really quite kind of fascinating, I guess. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Well, there we will must leave things. If people want to listen to the podcast, how do they access it? I can put links in the show notes, but please do.
Yes, you can access it directly through the Forward's website, forward.com. It's on all the usual platforms. It's on Apple, it's on Spotify, it's on Stitcher. It is playing Anne Frank. And we have published 3 episodes so far, and the 4th episode coming up. There will be 7 in all, plus bonus episodes to follow.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, all the best with it, Adam. And thank you so much for spending the time to have a chat with us about Anne Frank. And we may speak again. You never know.
Okay. Thanks so much. And best of luck with the podcast.
All the best. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.